Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth there, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe.
Hey, everybody out there in Milwaukee Mob Land. This is your host, Wayne Klugman, with a very, very interesting guest tonight. We're quite honored to have the famous writer, the really cool-looking guy, the man that would do all things to all people. Yes, we're talking about he himself, the famous, the wonderful, the really, truly, coolly good-looking guy, the writer who would be writing an award before he goes on to win the Oscars. I'm talking Alan Lindblom. Good afternoon, sir. How are you doing?
How you doing? I've never had anyone describe me like that. You know, truly good looking.
Except my wife.
Right. She'll swear up and down I'm the most handsome man in the world. But you're coming in a close second there, Wayne.
What can I tell you, sir? What can I tell you? So we know what you're involved with now, right? We know you're doing the writing. We know you're doing, you know, you have a book coming out soon, right? In fact, it comes out, I think, in 2 days, if I'm not mistaken.
No.
We know.
No, it's April 15th it comes out. So there was some confusion originally. The release date was originally March 31st, but it was pushed back 2 weeks because of some marketing issues. But April 15th, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, but before you got to this point, you had led a really interesting life, if I may say so, sir. Can you tell us how that all evolved?
It's interesting life. That's funny you put it like that. Until recently, I guess I never really honestly thought of my life as interesting, which is, I guess, but in hindsight, when I look back and my wife and people point out, even now when I tell stories to my wife, sometimes she looks at me like she doesn't know me, and I understand a lot of people do that as I write these stories called the Lindblom Chronicles for a website called National Crime Syndicate, which is syndicated, no pun intended, by Gangster Report, which is written by Scott Bernstein, who's a really famous crime historian, mafia historian, documentarian. And anyway, so all these people, these stories are incredible and interesting. And when my wife does the proofing before I do the final, you know, send it over to these guys, she kind of looks up at me, and the look she gives me sometimes is like, dude, I don't know you. And she does, but I share it occasionally. You know, I've been with her for over 7 years. You know, I was in prison for the last 13 years. So if your listeners don't know, they know now. I spent the last 13 years in prison for, you know, numerous crimes, but you know, extortion and bank robbery and a few other crimes. But, you know, she knows most of my stories, and I've told my wife most of my past, but then there's a very dark side of my past and history that I haven't shared. I don't share with her. I didn't share with her. You know, I'm ashamed of it, embarrassed of it. Some things I don't want her to be comfortable with. But then I write these things down. She looks up and goes, "Wow!" You know, and so it's the same thing. Like even now, talking about it, when I write them down, there's friends from high school or friends from people that I knew that just like, "Wow, I thought I knew you," but you know, nobody knew me because I lived a double life. And that double life was, you know, I came from an organized crime family where I started working with the family when I was a teenager and just doing little odds and then odd jobs, and those kind of evolved into bigger odd jobs and the bigger rackets, and just, you know, and then I got into things like weightlifting and selling and doing steroids, and just became a kind of a contract muscle enforcement agent for my uncles Sal and Peter Tocco, who were of the Zarelli Tocco family in Detroit, and that's kind of how I lived a double life. It's a very cloaked and strange life because I had normal friends like anybody else who because it's weird because I had my father's last name, Lindblom, but not my mother's last name, which is Tocco. But my parents divorced when I was four, so I was raised by my grandma and grandpa Toko and my mother for until I was 14. And I could become more than they could handle, and they sent me back to my dad. But by then it was too late because I was already under the wing of my Uncle Sal and my Uncle Pete, who are just, you know, mom guys, especially my Uncle Pete,
right,
because he was only 12 years older than me, so he kind of took me on like a little brother, and he was a pretty bad guy, and he was, you know, always just, he didn't intend to work. He didn't intend to do anything but work the streets. He ended up in a biker gang and just, and also, you know, organized crew of wise guys. It's all they did was run rackets and scams and hustles and made a ton of money, but, had no intentions of ever going. So I just kind of was trained in the art of bending the law, finding the gray area in the law, or working, circumventing the law, if you will. And, you know, there's an angle for everything. And I've used this analogy with a lot of people. You know, the average person, when they get, well, they want a new outfit, you know, they go to the mall. When I want a new outfit, I just send a crackhead into the mall to steal the outfit, you know, or if I need.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not going to spend $200 for an outfit when I could pay a crackhead or someone's thief to steal for $50. And that's just the way it was with everything, you know. If I wanted whatever I wanted. I wanted a new car, it worked out like that. If I want clothes, or, I mean, I was just telling someone the other day how I had a guy, my cousin Giorgio, worked in a meat market near the neighborhood. The guy who owned my meat market, he did the payroll every Tuesday at noon. I'll never forget it because we did this every Tuesday for years. And I'd call him ahead of time, and I sold pot, and he was a pothead. So I'd call him up, say, Giorgio, I need this, that, and the other. It'd be like about 100, you know, I was a bodybuilder, so I was in the, you know, I needed my protein. I needed chicken breast and turkey breast and steaks and burger. I'd tell him to put together about a $100 order. When the owner left to do payroll on Tuesday, I'd show up, and it was one of those deli-type deals. You walk up, you take a number. It was like a real nice neighborhood called Grosse Pointe, Michigan, so it's rich people. Everybody's rich. And I'd walk right to the front of the little line and be like, hey, Giorgio, but we'd speak in Italian, and I'd hand him, you know, as I reached over the counter to shake his hand, I'd slip him a bag of wheat, which is just, you know, $20 bag of wheat, which really cost me about $2 because I bought wheat in bulk, you know, pounds, 10, 20 pounds. And so then he'd hand me this, pull out of the freezer, this big package of meat, and, you know, enough to last me a week, like $100 worth of meat. And that was just the way my life worked. You know, I used to bribe the butcher at the local store, because I'd go to the grocery store and I'd look at these, you know, these big family sized like pot roasts or things, and they'd be like, you know, $30-$40, but I don't need one that big. So I'd tell the guy who worked in the back, I said, hey, listen, man, you know, they give you that joint. You knock this down, like, you know, outdated, give it to me for $2 or something. There's always an angle. That's all I'm trying to sell you. So that's how I started young, and it, you know, and then just when you grow up that way, as you get older, you become desensitized to the law, and you think, you know, this is just the way it is. And I was raised in a family where everybody was telling you, you know, an honest man's work day is a sucker's, you know, you just, so even though my grandpa worked, he owned a produce business in the Eastern Market of Detroit, you know, he's a big bookie, and, you know, imagine most of his money came from that, his sports books, and my uncle, just one of those things, you know, that eventually got me caught up. Eventually, yeah.
Right, but I would think that's how your older relatives, guy, if I may say, got in the business themselves, because that's what they were used to growing up. They saw it in their own lives, right?
Yeah, it's very Freudian. You know, it's funny. One might even say Pavlovian, almost, because when you're, you know, I had, like I said, I had normal friends who lived normal lives, but I was not allowed to talk about my other life, although there was a few friends who knew, you know, from newspaper articles and, you know, the news, of, you know, somebody would get busted in the news and throw up our, you know, our family name on the TV or be in the newspaper. And then a few people connected dots who knew my mother was a toco. I was a toco. They knew my – because I lived with my grandparents for years, and then they'd my grandpa would answer the phone, Peter Toco, and then all of a sudden, you know, one day there'd be a thing on the news that say, oh, so it's the Pete Toco is busted in this or investigated or indicted or, you know, it could be my uncle because his name was Pete. My grandpa's name was Pete. My other uncle's name was Pete. And also there was, you know, my Uncle Jack, who was the boss of the family, and then there's all these tocos, and it's always in the news and papers. So they knew something was up, but I always kind of deflated it, said it's bull crap, it's no nothing, because, you know, there was an instance in my family, in our crew one time, where my uncle had brought an outsider in who wasn't – that's another thing about Detroit. Unlike a lot of families, like especially New York, they bring guys in who are not – they're outsiders, they're not part of the family, who are just, you know, Johnny whoever down the block, you know, the kid who wants to hustle, whatever – doesn't work like that in Detroit. Most of the people, there's like five major families. They've all kind of intermarried through, you know, marrying off their daughters and sons to each other. And so it's very tight knit and you don't bring outsiders in. So one time my uncle had a guy working for him and they brought, you know, the guy was in a strip club or something, you know, bragging about how he's connected. And he threw out a couple of names, you know, and then of course, somebody who shouldn't have overheard it, and then it got back to my uncle, and then actually got back to the boss, and the boss gave down the order that, you know, guy had to go. So he turned up dead in a garage a few days later in Detroit, an abandoned house. And I was young, probably 17 years old, but I remember that, and it stuck in my head thinking, you know, if I ever tell any of my buddies and my friends, my normal friends, about, you know, what's going on in the family, the reason why I disappear sometimes for days or weeks at a time, you know, if they get around talking to the wrong guy, talking about, oh, my buddy L, he's connected, he's this, that, and the other, and then the wrong person overhears it, they might be the next guy end up in the garage. So I never talked about it much, and it's just one of those things. I think a lot of people are being, it's a revelation to a lot of people. Now that I'm, you know, writing about my childhood and teen years and before prison, I mean, I've had a lot of people reach out and say that, holy crap, I thought I knew you. But then, you know, there's a lot of guys who reach out and be like, you know what? Now it all makes sense. Your disposition, the way you carried yourself, the fear, you know, the fearlessness or the attitude or the whatever, you know, it just, they say, oh, you know what? Now it makes sense. But
yeah,
it was a weird double life, that's for sure.
It has to be. I mean, in fact, I would imagine it would be difficult to do anything other than what you ended up being involved because your family were in it, and everybody looked up to that. You're going to do what your family is doing, right?
Yeah, I looked up to my uncles a lot, and they're kind of like idols. But it was difficult to do anything other than that because, like I said, it's Pavlovian. I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know how to do anything else. I couldn't work. If I tried to work, I thought, man, this is ridiculous. I'm going to work. What am I doing? Making $8 an hour, $10 an hour? I could go hit the street and make $1,000 in the next 2 hours, or, you know, or $1,000 in a day or two. What a scam or racket! I could sell some fake steroids. I could rob a guy. I could do this. I could hustle that. Sell weed. There's 1,000 angles at any given moment in my mind I could have done. You know, I'd watch my uncles do it all the time. They could be broke one day, and have $40,000 in their pocket the next day. You know, you know, my buddies would work an entire year to make that much money. And these guys made that in a day or two sometimes, you know. I'm like, I just couldn't do it.
Yeah, I mean, does it make it right, but I understand why people are drawn to lifestyle? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I never really looked at it right and wrong. I guess in hindsight, I look back and a part of me knew it was wrong, but a part of me thought, it's not that wrong. I never was into the robbing people, too, like, until the end. I didn't rob innocent people, usually. I did a couple times, but usually it was, like, drug dealers and pimps were the ones, you know. You know, pimps are kind of scumbags to me, so they're easy targets. You know, they're really easy to rob in Detroit because they all hang out in the same areas, and you can watch them from across the street. There's a street, you know, 8 Mile Road or Woodward Avenue in Detroit. You got these pimps, and they just, you know, they work these girls for a few hours. You watch them collect probably $1,000 in a couple hours. And then a guy like me just walks up with the pistol in their mouth and says, give me the money, and game over. And they give it up. That's, you know, whatever. See how fast it is? I just made $1,000 in 5 minutes.
And
I robbed the pimp. What's he going to do, call the cops?
Yeah, he's not gonna, right. Yeah, because if I get the stuff wrong, forgive me. I mean no disrespect, but it's my understanding that most people disrespect pimps. Do I understand that correctly? That pimps are kind of like in a low scum level of crime?
Yeah, well, for when it comes to organized crime, sure. You know, a pimp thinks
yeah.
he's a pimp until a gangster puts a gun in his face. I
yeah.
rob them all the time. They all,
yeah,
you know, I get
I mean,
their hustle. That's their hustle. But you know, my hustle was taking money from a pimp. I robbed a lot of drug dealers too. That was one of my adrenaline rushes, you know. And there, I've talked about that in a couple other interviews. But you know, it just basically we had strippers and stuff that worked inside the strip clubs, and one of these drug dealers would come in with a bunch of money, and they'd just tip us off, and we'd follow them and we'd rob them. You know, I mean, that's it. We put mask on, found these. They always went to breakfast after the strip club. The girls might lie and say, "We'll meet you here, or there, or whatever." Just you know, go up to the local, you know, breakfast diner, Greasy Spoon, Coney Island is what we have here.
Okay.
And meet us there, or just and then we just walk in with masks. You know, two or three of us, a couple of me and cousin, and what a shotgun. You know, and people always think, "Well, that's crazy. Nobody did nothing." I'm like, "What would you do if two masked guys walked in with 12 gauge shotguns at 3 o'clock in the morning?" And it didn't pay you no attention, but walked straight over to the guys at the table who looked like some drug dealers, told them to get on the floor, zip-tied them, and took their money and jewelry. Nobody says nothing.
Yeah.
I bet you there was cops who watched us do it before, you know, undercover. And they said, "What the hell do I give a crap?" I mean, that's the way
yeah.
Detroit
yeah,
works.
Yeah, I mean, I can't risk my life for a drug dealer, you know. Right.
Right, exactly. Some,
yeah.
some punk-ass drug dealers
I,
at 3 o'clock in the morning. Even a cop ain't
right.
going to do it.
Okay, I'm going to do it. I would agree with that, absolutely. Wow, I mean...
And it's a shock and awe thing, too, you know. Everybody, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and if there's a club, they've been drinking, they're in there, you know, having some laughs and some breakfast, and all of a sudden here come two guys walking in with shotguns, and, you know, it's not like Pulp Fiction where you're screaming, get on the ground. You just walk straight up to the dope dealers and say, game over, you know, get on the ground, and take their money
yeah.
and jewelry, zip tie them, and walk out. People in the right, it's quiet, nobody
age.
Says a word.
Huh? No, and a 12 gauge is a pretty big hole in the barrel.
Yeah, it's intimidating. It's an intimidating gun.
Yeah.
You rack it when you walk in one time or something. it's you know, not glamorizing
yeah.
that, but it's just, you know, one of the things that we did.
It's the fact. It's the fact that it is my opinion, from my experiences in life, that nothing gets people's attention than racking a shotgun. Because people know what that means.
I have to 100% agree with that. Yeah. I mean, you can get their attention with a pistol, but you rack around in a 12 gauge.
Yeah.
And everybody, you'd be amazed how quiet some places would get. You could literally hear a pin drop when that happens. Nobody moves. Nobody says a word. Even the fry cook
yeah.
in the back stops cooking. No.
Yeah, and they want you. All they want you to do is to make you happy, so you go away.
I think a lot
yeah.
of the time, I think everybody they're in shock. Like, it's not even that they're scared. They're like, "Holy crap, this is really happening." One of those moments, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do indeed.
Well, you know, I don't think anyone else in the restaurant really felt much of a threat, especially the way we just targeted a couple of guys or something, but. Anyways, one of those things in life. But, no, like I said, that's...
It is one of those things. And that's that life. That was the life that you led at the time. But before we go on to any more stories, I have to, looking at the time, where can we find your information online? What are your social media sites, sir?
Oh, well, I'm Instagram is Gunny989. On Facebook is just my name, Alan Lindblom. Which is, you know, I still have room for more friends on Facebook, and anyone who wants to follow or whatever. But also, I have a page for my book that's coming out April 15th called To Be a King, which is the name of the book. So the name of the page is To Be a King. And so you can go to Facebook, To Be a King, and that should come up.
Okay. Are you not on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. But what is it? Gunner Detroit, my wife. She's in another room. Gunner Detroit.
Okay. At Gunner Detroit, okay.
What is it, honey?
Thank you.
Yeah, my Instagram and Twitter is Gunner Detroit. Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Thank you, sir.
People are more than welcome to follow me, and I post a lot of stuff. It's all kind of new
you
to
do.
Me. Again, I've only been out of prison for 8 months and some change. So, you know, I'm just trying to get used to the stuff. I got Facebook pretty much, you know, figured out, but the Instagram and the Twitter, stuff like that, is all new.
It takes time. I'm sure that Facebook, if you can pick up Facebook, and you pick up the rest of it. And nobody can do all of it. Nobody can do all the social media. You can't. And you find out which one works for you the best. That's my recommendation, is use the one that you think works best for you and tell it.
Oh, right now Facebook kind of went. But, you know, again, I've come out of prison. I don't know nothing. The last phone I had was a Nextel Flip. I got locked up in early 2003 and walked out end of last July. So, you know, there's a whole technological evolution had taken place since I was gone. You know, there's nothing like a touchscreen or a smart anything. You know, Facebook didn't exist. None of that stuff existed when I went away. And so now, but it's fun learning. You know, it's a lot of fun. The stereo of my car, I have a Jeep Commander, is run by an iPad. So, the whole system.
Yeah.
2,000 watt stereo system. It's run by an iPad. Go figure.
Yeah. I mean, it's beyond me. I mean, we have an older car, so we don't have that new tech. But I'm not a good looking rider like yourself, sir. I'm an old Batman.
Here you go again with the good looking.
Hey,
you know,
if I call you a good looking rider, I'm not worried about too much. If I call you a fat old man like I am, I don't want that son of that chat going to be jacked up. No, that's something I do want to avoid.
That's not going to happen. But when you call me this good-looking writer,
I'm obviously making light of it, but, you know, you get the point.
When you call me this good-looking writer, now I know you're lying to me, though. So.
No. All you know is I'm paying you a great compliment. That Wayne guy is a really nice guy. Maybe I know some hot girls in Milwaukee that you might want to meet up with.
No, I'm married, happily married.
Well, so am I, but you never
know. You never know. So my wife thinks it's the same thing. She says I'm the most handsome man in the world. And I guess that's all that matters.
It's all that matters. That's
we have two people.
And the thing is, too, when you tell – I live in the inner city, right? I live in the inner city. And I suffer from the fallacy of I wish the hell that the city of Racine, Wisconsin – had a strong, organized crime family, because a lot of this petty any crime wouldn't exist if we had one. But it's a fallacy, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. You know, Detroit used to be like that. Where I grew up in Detroit was a really strange, section of the east side of Detroit where it was almost all Italians and Greeks. Mostly Italians, maybe 10-15% Greeks, but they're just like Italians anyways. But then what happened was in the city, you know, it started getting worse. The Italians moved across Alter Road and into Grosse Pointe, and then it became, you know, that whole section of Grosse Pointe was all Italian. That's kind of where I grew up, and that's all big money and still real nice today. But back to what you're saying is, yeah, the Italians and the bosses in those neighborhoods, they controlled, you know, nobody, they didn't let drug dealers come in or riffraff or undesirables because, you know, they get handled pretty quick. I mean, you know, like my Uncle Pete and Uncle Sal, for example, tough guys from the neighborhood. And if you had any troublemakers come in the neighborhood, they'd grab a baseball bat and go tune them up quick. And that's him and their boys. That's how they did. You didn't see anybody cross that Alter Road. I mean, if they stuck a toe over Alter Road, they get their head cracked with a crowbar or a baseball bat. And that's just the way it was. You know, it's still like that a little bit, but it's not the same. But in my book that I write, which is a fiction novel, by the way, there's a, you know, there's a neighborhood that's based on my old neighborhood, and that's kind of how the main character, Omnio Falcone, you know, that's how he guards his own neighborhood in that same fashion. He doesn't let anybody kind of come in the neighborhood, and they kind of look at him as like they call him, him and his crew, the Robin Hoods, because, you know, they help, you know, old lady out who maybe can't pay her house mortgage or bills, or they, you know, make sure that she gets to church, food on Christmas, whatever. They'll help people out in the neighborhood, but the neighborhood protects them. So, you know, if something happens, say, for example, something happens in the neighborhood, nobody's going to testify against nothing. And I mean, that's just the way it is.
Right. It's kind of like the early 1300s in England. As long as the nobility took care of the robber barons at the time, took care of the people below them, because when push came to shove, it would be the opposite way around. The peasants and stuff would have to join up to protect their neighborhoods. Yeah, they needed each other to live.
Well, that's how it was in Sicily, and it still is today to some degree. A lot of people don't realize that Sicily has its own president, the sovereign from, you know, Rome and northern Italy. But that's exactly how it was and still is, you know, a couple hundred years ago, dating back to a couple thousand years ago. Yeah, Sicily was like that. You had what's called Omnios, and that's where the name of the character in my book is named Omnio, which is Latin for, like, a local king. And your Omnio had Ducati. Ducati are basically like dukes, and they just protected the people, and then they basically looked out for the people. And if anyone had a problem, then they would intervene, and they would, you know, they were fair, but they didn't like petty crime didn't happen. Sexual crimes, rapes, you know, any kind of crime against women, you'd be killed for that. You know, and that's who early mob bosses from 2,000 years ago. You know, if you claim that this guy, you know, raped your daughter or tried to hit on your wife or stole your cow, it didn't matter. You would go to a Ducati. They couldn't sell it, then it settled that. They'd go to an Omnio, and he'd make the final decision. And if he says you go, that's it. It's over. You know, they might kill your whole family, all the males anyways.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting how things were and how they evolved over time. I mean, we know about the Black Hand, and they weren't too particular who they picked on. But, you know, when they all came over here from Italy back in the day, in the early 1900s.
Yeah, Black Hand just picked on the other immigrants.
Right.
For the most part.
Right. For the most part, right. Because to my understanding, I'm no expert, it was too fluid at the time to have one strong family, because to take over, to be the heads, they get to deal with the less than nice people, to pick on the poor innocents. Wow. Well, sir, we're up against the clock of tonight's show. I know you'll be on tomorrow at the same time. We're going to take you to the time, to about the time you went to prison and your situation in prison, and how it's that, what incidents happened in prison that changed your life for the better. Right, sir?
Sure, absolutely.
Outstanding, sir. Well, I do want to thank you for coming on for part one. And quickly, can we get one more time, because I know people didn't have pens write down anything, because people are stupid like that. Can we get your social media sites one more time, please, sir?
My Facebook is my name, Alan Lindblom. And my Twitter and Instagram is Gunner Detroit. And my Twitter, and that's it, Gunner Detroit.
Gunner Detroit, all right, now we have enough fun, sir.
Also, To Be a King is my book page, so like that page, and, you know, you'll get sample chapters and alerts to when some things are happening, promotions and things like that.
Outstanding, sir. Outstanding. Well, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show tonight. I'm looking forward to tomorrow night as well. For those people out there and Blog Talk Airline, the link will be posted. Some of it will come up tonight. The rest of it will come up tomorrow. Takes time to germinate out there, it seems. But I want to thank everybody for listening. Again, I want to thank you, Mr. Lindberg. I'm sorry. I knew I'd screw up your name. It happens.
Thank you again for being
on the show tonight. And we'll talk to you soon, sir.
We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, sir. Yep. Good night. Good night, everyone.
Yeah, good
Have
night.
A great evening. Yep. Bye.
Thank you.